The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on Governor Chris Sununu's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. We have somebody on the phone taking minutes in the office, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. As mentioned, today's meeting is also being recorded. Should you be a speaking participant and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will facilitate today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91-A, there are a few logistics that we must establish. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us in the room. We'll do that with this roll call. By example, I am Jerry Little, Director of the Gopher, in Gopher Office, One Eagle Square, Concord. And in the room with me are Rhonda Hensley and Kate Spiner of the Gopher Office. Senate President Donna Soucy.
Good afternoon. This is Donna Soucy. I am at my home in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you. House Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Thank you, Jerry. Steve Shurtleff. I'm in my cabin in Bethlehem, and I'm alone.
Senate Republican Leader Chuck Morris.
Chuck Morris. I'm in my office in Arlington, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you. House Republican Leader Dick Hinch.
This is Dick Hinch. I am in my office in Merrimack, and I am alone.
Senate Finance Chairman, Senator Lou D'Alessandro.
Lou D'Alessandro. I'm in Manchester in my kitchen, and my wife is with me.
House Finance Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
This is Mary Jane Wallner. I'm in my home in Concord, New Hampshire, and no one is with me.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan is in my home office alone.
Thank you, sir. And Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy, I'm in my house in Littleton with my two minor children.
Thank you. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call following the process we just used. Finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to use 5-star if you would like to ask a question. All presenters are asked to also hit 5-star when their turn comes up, and that allows us to unmute your line. Are there any questions before we begin today's scheduled presentations? Very good. Our first speaker is going to be Charles Ansell, Chief Operating Officer for the Community College System of New Hampshire. Mr. Ansell, could you hit 5-star for us, please, so we can identify your line? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ansell. And I would also like to note that Rhonda Hensley sent out a little while ago an email to everyone on the advisory board with all of the attachments for all of the speakers on today's meeting. Mr. Ansell, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. So I'm Charles Ansell, Chief Operating Officer with the Community College System of New Hampshire, and I am in my office in Concord alone. And I genuinely thank each of you for taking time with us today. I imagine that having so many conference calls like this requires serious stamina, and I feel, you know, very fortunate that we have this opportunity to present to you in the thick of it all. Throughout this pandemic at the community college system, we've prioritized our students. We serve a sizable portion of the entire state population. 95% of our students live in New Hampshire, and nearly all of our graduates stay in state. And more than 10% of the graduates from the university system get their start with us. More to the point of the proposal, the document that should be in front of you or was emailed to you, but to the point of our proposal, our 25,000 students that I just mentioned, they include those who are looking to change careers, often because they got laid off, and they know we set people up to get good jobs here. So we give you a 9-page report called COVID Impacts, Relief Needs for Program Completion, and Workforce Training. And I'm going to summarize a lot of that for you. Given that we serve so many students, the first request in the document is critical. We need to educate our students safely so they can graduate in key sectors that our economy needs right now, in healthcare, obviously, but also in IT and in industry and in the sciences. The second part of the document is a fast-forward program to provide economic relief associated with coronavirus fallout. So the document you have is essentially in three parts: a description of how we have responded to the coronavirus crisis, details on the first request for safe learning environments, and then details on a relief request for the state's economic recovery. I'll walk through all three. So for CCS&H, we are fortunate that we introduced recent cost savings measures across all 7 colleges so that we all run on the same technology for student learning. This is not common in most university and community college systems in this country, and our common setup for back office functions, particularly in technology, really served us well in this crisis. We run leanly, and we are always looking to measure our performance. Before the COVID pandemic, our weekly metrics-driven tracking of how students and faculty were using technology in the classroom made the transition to remote instruction pretty seamless. We have one setup, one manager, and one department, and within 1 week, we were at essentially 100% of faculty and students learning remotely. This allowed us to immediately focus on helping students. In 1 week, we implemented a new resource for students, free online licensed clinical support for those who need it, helping them cope with family stress caused by COVID, as well as with recent economic impacts that have fallen out as a result. We modified and extended payment plan deadlines, food pantries remained open, we provided emergency grant aid for many students, as so many of them have parents who are now sick and have kids who are now at home. We estimate that half of our students lost a job, and most have a parent or a dependent who lost a job, all mostly in sectors that have temporarily vanished. So many are teetering on a financial cliff. On the other hand, because they are enrolled with us, all of them are on track. Even in these trying times, all of them are still on track to a promising career. So our focus has been getting them through immediate needs so they don't have to forego their future. In addition to all this, we built a 300-bed medical surge site for the Concord region, working with FEMA, the state, the National Guard, and area hospitals, and we will host a mobile testing clinic for the Lakes region. While CCS&H itself experienced revenue loss, as outlined in the document, our colleges are really focused now on what our students and our state needs. Now, some of these new supports and some of this emergency aid is covered by federal legislation from the CARES Act and from FEMA. Some of it is not, and we will easily exceed what is provided from federal legislation. And obviously, we have revenue shortfall for which we believe we will unlikely receive reimbursement, which tightens the screw since we already operate with many cost efficiencies in place. Our first request, which is on page 3 of the document, totals $2.5 million. Like the university system, we are requesting relief associated with coronavirus fallout, but our ask is a little different. As I already stated, our online operations are fine, but to prepare people for the jobs New Hampshire needs, since our students stay in state and get employed here, we prepare many of our students in lab settings. So imagine the welding lab, the IT security center, the mock ambulance, the dental clinic, the respiratory care setting. We furnish those. These are hands-on programs we must deliver in person. Our instructors will extend their hours, doing so to accommodate small numbers of students in lab spaces during what will likely end up being a socially distant fall semester. We also need to capture our lectures online in these environments and share video feed to make more of our classes hybrid. In other words, with online and face-to-face components running at the same time. We have tabulated this against our programs and the capital intensity and technology required for each, and we came to the $2.5 million number you see here. We also anticipate need to undertake broad COVID testing, and we do not yet have a cost estimate for that. So that's our first request. Our second request is about the New Hampshire economy. Since our students stay in state, our success is dictated by the needs of the state. For this reason, our curriculum is very practical. It comes from what employers tell us they need, and we graduate students into jobs with living wages that lead to strong careers in this state. We fix unemployment problems. It's what we do. We are the first line of attack against high unemployment rates, against prolonged payouts of unemployment assistance, and against stalled careers. Providing relief funds is critical, as many students cannot afford anything right now, and again, we believe that at least half of our students have been laid off. Many will not be eligible for financial aid, and even if they are, they still will have unmet need. We have what relief from the fallout of this pandemic would look like based on what we expect unmet financial need to be between now and December 31st, 2020. Now, this request, in some ways, may represent a contrasting model to other requests you may be getting. For economic relief, you can apply funds to struggling companies, to struggling organizations, and to whole sectors decimated by the pandemic. But this proposal is not a community college system rescue plan. This relief proposal is a reaction to market forces, and more importantly, it also anticipates them. We partner with the Department for Business and Economic Affairs and with the Department of Employment Security to see what the future will look like and how we can make sure that anyone currently unemployed can readily enter the new economy that is already starting to emerge. This, in turn, can put New Hampshire on the fast track to recovery. We know IT and healthcare and many of the other sectors we serve, as outlined in this document, will be the most resilient parts of the new economy and will demand the most jobs, and that these jobs will pay well, will lead to good careers, and in a reinforcing way, attract businesses to New Hampshire. What does that actually look like? Well, our full-time students come out of the unemployment rate. They end up, and they will continue to end up, working in hospitals, classrooms, server closets, mechanical shops, and offices throughout the state. And on the pages in the second half of the document in front of you, you see what that looks like in the medical assistantships, respiratory technicians, and nurses we provide, including in nursing homes, in IT and all the cloud services and cybersecurity workforce prep as the economy increasingly sits on top of these tools, and in manufacturing and in sectors not depicted, including industry and construction, various STEM fields, addiction counseling, and other areas of workforce shortage, even during recession. So suffice it to say here that this proposal will allow us to do three things. One, it will allow us to immediately meet occupational needs to address the public health crisis. Two, it will work with the recently unemployed to provide more than a check but a new career. And three, it will allow us to meet students in their time of high financial need and insecurity in a traditional college landscape, because higher education cannot be traditional right now, cannot be broken or off balance, and the community college system cannot afford to miss a beat. Because in every economic downturn, community colleges play the same role. This is a conversation that is presently happening between community colleges and state legislatures across America. We are the engine that restarts the recovery, and the more you rev that engine, the more quick the economic bounce back. That's why we added a component for about $2 million to ensure that we comprehensively meet New Hampshire's needs for job placement. This means having COVID relief career placement advising staff aligned with a position to meet workforce development needs, which, though we predict them, we know will be fluid. We will directly tie students to careers in partnership with the Department of Employment Security, and we will be able to directly tether our graduation numbers to reducing the unemployment rate. We don't want to be like some other state with lingering unemployment that goes on and puts a drain on our economy and lets our human capital sit idle. I'm going to wrap up by saying that crises like these often replicate existing economic conditions. By doing so, they exacerbate them, and that's unfortunate. Right now, the people in our state with the least ability to afford higher education come to us. People who have the least means are experiencing tremendous loss right now. People who just lost a job, they come to us, and we are asking you to help us help them, as our job is to help them go from college to careers and help the state go from recession to relief to recovery. As noted in the document you have, we have a track record of strong financial management, efficient use of resources, and making what we get go a very, very long way. Relief and recovery for our students is the same as relief and recovery for the state. So thank you for hearing us out, and please, if you have any questions for me, fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Ansell. Are there questions from members of the committee for Mr. Ansell regarding the community college system requests? Mr. Ansell, I do have a question. This is Jerry Little. Regarding the graph on page 2, where you've outlined the ask, about halfway down there is a section that is lightly shaded gray with check marks in the column covered by higher ed grants, question mark.
Yep.
Are you indicating there that those funds will be covered by other grants that you're not seeking any CARES Act funding for those items?
Yes, that's right. So it's going to be covered by the appropriation that the community college system received from the CARES Act in the higher education portion. It roughly equates to that sort of earmark for institutional support.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Ansell? Give you a minute to hit 5-star if you have a question. Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a question for us, sir?
I do. I've got a couple. I apologize if there's any confusion. Two things. First of all, there's been a lot of controversy over the closing of a program at the Technical Institute, and that's the daycare situation. I'd like you to address that and how it plays into the functioning of the teaching schedule there, where you produce people who will get involved in daycare and will learn the wherewithals of how to work in that environment. That's the first thing. Second thing is you did have some layoffs, and how has that been handled, and what adjustments do you look for in the future? Thank you.
Great. So I'll take the questions in that order. So first, yes, the child care center. You know, the quick summary is that, like child care centers across the country, we did close the Child and Family Development Center at NHTI during the COVID pandemic. So, yes, the pandemic instigated the closure. That said, you know, this is something that's a bit of ongoing discussion, because every year the child care center at NHTI operates at a loss of about $280,000. The cumulative effect of that is that it essentially racks up a deficit the size of its own operating budget every 3 years. So that's not really coronavirus related. That is just the math of running the operation in normal times, which requires subsidizing the child care center through other operating funds at that college. So put simply, throughout our system, we don't let structural deficits like that linger, and that requires us making tough decisions. But it allows us to keep our focus on being affordable, on being of high educational quality, and on being responsive to the economic needs of the state. We always are putting as much resources as possible to the classroom, and that's why, for example, we not only look at things like the child care center, but we share as many back office functions as possible so the bulk of our budget can go to teaching, learning, and student support. So, yeah, all that said, the president of the college temporarily closed the center, but is looking to reopen in a way that closes the deficit and is sustainable in the long term and still provides early childhood education service for our students. So, you know, any discussion on that would certainly warrant further conversation with myself and as well as with the president of NHTI. I'm going to pivot to the second question, if that's all right, and then if there's callbacks to either of these, let's go for it. So with regards to the layoffs, yes, so just to reiterate, there were essentially 8 layoffs at NHTI earlier this year. This is because NHTI had some significant enrollment decline of about 10% fall to fall. The result was we wanted to make sure that we brought our expenses in line with revenue. You know, we don't want to end up in a situation, you know, not to pick on anybody, but, you know, like Connecticut or Vermont, where because of, you know, long-term absorption of a structural deficit, they end up having to look at things like potentially closing colleges and laying off people in the hundreds. You know, on an ongoing basis, we really have an eye at all times to our reserves ratios, our debt coverage ratio, and our net income, and then we make sure that since we operate on really, really thin margins and put everything back in the classroom, that we don't let any structural deficits linger. So that was the justification for those layoffs. All the academic there were no academic programs or departments that were closed as a result. We saw NHTI have stronger than expected enrollment in the spring semester, and we're looking forward to, you know, normal operations and moving forward. And then obviously this pandemic hit. But, you know, by and large, I think that the community and NHTI more broadly was, you know, pretty much at the end of the road of that until the pandemic hit.
Further questions, Senator D'Alessandro?
Just a quick follow-up. If indeed this child care program was a recruiting tool in terms of inducing enrollment, will a modification of the program hurt you as far as recruiting students who want to go into that program? And where else could they go at this point in time?
Yeah, so I can go into some detail on that. And again, I want to, you know, make sure that it's clear that, you know, I'd really like to involve the president of NHCI, who's been very involved in these discussions to date. But, you know, at some of our other colleges, at White Mountains, and, you know, as you know, at Manchester Community College, we have transitioned how we have a setup with our child care centers such that they aren't an exclusive auxiliary budget that an entity that's run by the college itself, but it's run in partnership with somebody who can oversee the child care operations, and then it can still serve at that lab function. And so you see no diminishment in recruitment to the early childhood education program. I don't want to get too far ahead of where the president of NHCI might want to go with this, but I do want to reemphasize that the center was closed temporarily, just like all child care centers, and is looking to reopen in a way that is just more sustainable but would still be able to meet that recruitment need. And again, I just want to reemphasize, too, that this is something to solve because of a ongoing structural deficit that the child care center was always running, and it really doesn't you know, we didn't include it as part of this proposal to you today because it's really not related to the COVID pandemic.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Senator Susi.
Thank you, Commissioner Little. Actually, my question is in follow-up to the question Senator D'Alessandro asked about the child care center. And I'm wondering if some of the federal funding that has come into the state could possibly be used, because I understand your comments about it being an educational opportunity, but I also think it's a significant there's a significant need to ensure we have adequate child care in place to get the workforce back to work as soon as we phase in. So I'm wondering if you could, in consultation with the president, come up with a number that might get that up and running more quickly to serve that much needed service within the Concord community.
Yeah, you know, certainly. We're definitely open to trying to figure this out. You know, I just obviously, you know, and I'm not just trying to, you know, refocus to what I presented, but I do want to call out, you know, in contrast, right, that the document that you have and what I summarized, you know, is really, you know, about the classroom and getting the unemployment rate way back down, you know, as so much has changed in just a matter of, like, 4 weeks. You know, this, we could certainly find ways to use funds to keep the child care center going. You know, it is something that we do need to solve the sort of ongoing structural deficit that it has. So, like you're suggesting, I would want to make sure that we do that in such a way that balances the long-term sustainability of it, because I just worry about, you know, I want to figure it out, and I want to make sure that we do it in a way that doesn't over-rely on a one-time infusion. That's all. So, you know, I was hoping that there would be a way to do a similar partnership to what had been set up in Manchester, but it's something that we can definitely explore and connect with the president of NHTI on.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Ansell, or is there anyone else with you, Mr. Ansell, that has anything they'd like to say on behalf of the community college system?
There's nobody physically in the office with me because we're being very good. But if somebody else is on the line from the community college system who has anything to add, you know, feel free. And I really do hope that, you know, this is something that if anybody has further questions, you know, anybody who knows me on this call knows that I'm always available by phone and email, and I would love to talk about how, you know, we can be the fulcrum of any sort of state recovery, because I really believe this is personally why I'm in this job, and I really believe that we can provide that service.
Thank you, sir. And last call for questions for Mr. Ansell. I'm not seeing any on the screen or hearing any. We will say thank you, sir, very much.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. Really appreciate the time.
Our pleasure.
Bye.
The next presentation we have this afternoon is from the Independent Pharmacy Association. Mr. Rochefort, are you on the phone with us? Eastern States Compound Pharmacy.
I am, yes.
Very good. Thank you very much. Go ahead and tell us what you'd like the committee to hear.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this time. You know, as the commissioner has stated, my name is David Rochefort. I'm a pharmacist, and I own Eastern States Compounding Pharmacy in Littleton. And on behalf of the New Hampshire Independent Pharmacists Association, our 12 owners and 15 locations, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this afternoon. One thing you'll notice as you read through the notes, I am a pharmacist, not an English major. So I apologize for some of the typos that came through there. One of the things that you just want to highlight, you know, the name independent pharmacist is really rings true. So asking for some forgiveness or asking for help and assistance during this time is really foreign to us. But what isn't foreign to us is taking care of people and being there when people need help. The pharmacists have been described as one of the most accessible healthcare professionals in the community, and nearly 90% of Americans live within 5 miles of a community pharmacy. Year after year, pharmacists are rated as one of the most trusted healthcare professionals by the public. And I mention these facts because before a front line was even identified in the COVID-19 pandemic, pharmacists were there in the communities talking to people. And serving the public. As we know, at the beginning of the pandemic, routine testing was scarce or even unavailable. Patients who were exhibiting symptoms and sought testing were turned away from hospitals and their doctor's offices unless they fit very narrow testing criteria. They were told to go home and self-monitor. In many cases, patients, prior to going home and without knowing if they were afflicted with the coronavirus, visited their local pharmacies for advice, counseling, and OTC remedies. These patients were never turned away from these community pharmacies. Despite being just several weeks into the COVID-19 pandemic, we've learned a lot about the diagnosis, treatment, prevention, and mitigation of this illness. Our requests of this committee are all based on the recommendations and guidances issued by OSHA, CDC, and the APHA, American Pharmaceutical Association. We are respectfully requesting $3.5 million to fund projects that will allow NHIPA members to comply with these recommendations. Of course, 6 months ago, these recommendations didn't exist. The term social distancing, spatial distancing, isolation, self-quarantining weren't part of any of our vocabularies. So there's no way that we could have predicted any of this 6 months ago. Compliance with these recommendations will ensure patients have safe and continued access to their medications with minimal disruption, ensuring medication compliance. Medication compliance reduces hospitalizations and saves resources, both physical resources and financial resources. In respect of your time, I've attached these source documents where our requests are based on. I'm not going to go into deep detail, but you have those in your packet. However, in summary, these projects include renovations to our facilities to comply with OSHA, CDC, and APHA guidances on spatial distancing, attempting to maintain 6 feet between coworkers and customers, and the addition of physical barriers between patients and staff. Also, on April 8, 2020, due to the community access pharmacists provide, the United States Department of Health and Human Services authorized licensed pharmacists to order and administer COVID-19 tests. Proper facilities will be needed for the safe and efficient administration of these testing protocols. Like the previous speaker, technology upgrades are going to be very important to our members. Technology upgrades are an area that our members have identified as a need for the COVID-19 response. OSHA issued a recommendation to change the patterns of commerce. These technological upgrades would be made to specifically comply with that guidance, including mobile application development and integration to existing software, telemedicine development to link pharmacies to patients and providers through electronic, telephonic, and video means in a manner that these services can be delivered efficiently, and remote pickup options that would allow patients to pick up their medications in a secure manner. This option is similar to curbside pickup, but this would not be dependent on the pharmacy being open. Additionally, delivery enhancements will also be made to comply with OSHA guidance document 3990032020, which I have included in your packet, as well as the APHA and CDC recommendation to use home delivery whenever possible. This would include delivery vehicles as well as specific software and GPS upgrades to ensure the safe and reliable administration of these services. As mentioned in my opening, pharmacies were on the front line of this before we knew a lot about COVID-19. Pharmacists were interacting with patients without the use of PPE, and when the CDC and APHA made recommendations that PPE should be used by pharmacy staff, the PPE was unavailable or already allocated to hospitals. Funding would allow pharmacies to develop their own adequate supplies for current and future needs. In 2006, the American Public Health Association stated, "Pharmacists offer an accessibility that is rare among healthcare professionals. The pharmacist has health knowledge on which to build and is often uniquely situated in the community to provide public health services, in some cases, 24 hours a day. No appointment is needed at most community pharmacies." Goes on to say, "This convenience creates a large window of opportunity in which to provide public health services, therefore filling a void related to care and prevention. Further, pharmacists in the community are in an ideal position to act as information services." And I want to add here that most of these services that are provided in the community by pharmacists are provided free of charge. All of this taken into consideration, our members are asking for funds for training, education, an incentive to better prepare their staff for the obvious role they serve now and will continue to do so in the future. A prepared and educated staff will increase a community pharmacy's value to the public. Some of the guidelines that were distributed to me late yesterday afternoon asked for specific measures for public reporting on the receipt and use of the public relief funds. So in talking to some of my colleagues, you know, many of us have benefited from the PPP funds that we've received from the SBA. Those funds were distributed through local banks, and the reporting and the receipt was conducted through there. We believe that this mechanism has served efficiently and effectively, and would recommend that the committee revisit or explore this type of disbursement model. I hope that in this short time that I've been able to highlight the critical role that pharmacy plays in access to healthcare services in New Hampshire. One thing to point out, in good times, best case scenario, when access to pharmacy is not disrupted, between $100 and $300 billion of avoidable healthcare costs in the United States are attributed to medication non-adherence. So, in times of pandemic, we can only guess how high that number would be if access to community pharmacy is disrupted. The community access to a pharmacy within 5 miles of 90% of Americans is vital. However, we feel with a modest funding request of $3.5 million that we can position our pharmacies to more efficiently and effectively serve the people of New Hampshire in a cost-effective manner that they've come to expect, all the while meeting the guidelines developed by federal government and industry leaders. I thank you for the time that you've given me. I would be happy to answer any questions that you have, and I neglected to mention that I am in Littleton in my office, and I am alone.
Thank you, Mr. Rochefort. Are there any questions from the members of the Legislative Advisory Board for Mr. Rochefort from the Independent Pharmacy Association? We'll give you a minute to log in. We're not seeing or hearing any, so thank you very much, Mr. Rochefort, for joining us this afternoon. Greatly appreciate the information.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Our next presentation is from the National Association of Chain Drugstores. Mr. Berkey, are you with us this afternoon?
I am, Director Little. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Bruce, go right ahead.
Okay, I wasn't sure whether I needed to hit 5-star or not, but I am here. And I want to first begin by saying thank you to you, your team at Gopher, and the members of Gopher. I know all of you, and I know that this is a trying time for all, but the time and efforts that all of you are putting into this crisis will pay dividends on the other side, and we are going to see that other side. So I will begin my remarks by just giving a little bit of an overview of the New Hampshire Association of Chain Drug Stores. As Mr. Rochford indicated, that you know people are live very nearby at your community pharmacy, and by virtue of the 11 members that we have here in New Hampshire with 224 stores and 638 pharmacists working in those stores, he's absolutely right. There is great access and great knowledge within the local communities through pharmacy. They also employ over 16,000 people in the state of New Hampshire. So it's a very robust structure. And with that in mind, we want to, you know, just not necessarily come and ask you for money today, but to ask you to help us help the citizens of New Hampshire by offering our services as additional capacity, testing capacity. We have begun to see this capacity develop in other states across the country. Mr. Rochford referenced the U.S. HHS order allowing pharmacists to order and administer COVID-19 tests. And as of yesterday, 27 states now provide for pharmacy-led COVID-19 testing. And so we're asking for, you know, if the governor moves in the direction of this, and we've had some initial discussions with the Board of Pharmacy, that, you know, an executive order that could, you know, waive some rules or restrictions that could have that could impede that ability to offer those tests, we would ask that an order of some kind be issued to enable that to happen. You know, the pharmacists are no strangers to point-of-care tests. 40 states already allow pharmacists to provide the necessary screenings and point-of-care tests for conditions such as the flu, and that is true here in New Hampshire. You see on their signs every fall, come in and get your flu shot. So the COVID-19 tests would be very, very similar in terms of the administering and the ability to do so. What I have found amazing and have seen on video over the last couple of weeks is in states, Walgreens shared this with us, and in states that are permitted to offer this testing now, they have been able to set up drive-through systems in their parking lots or tents in their parking lots. So they've been very aggressive about, you know, setting up and being able to have this activity going on and having this activity going on in a specific space, not on, you know, the floor of the pharmacy itself. So this can work, and we're hopeful that we can get this working in New Hampshire. And going forward, you know, once there is a vaccine in place for this horrible virus, we would also, you know, seek to have, to have pharmacists also to administer the virus, the vaccine. And so preparing now is vital, you know, for being able to do that down the road. They can be scaled up quickly and safely during pandemics for either the testing or the vaccines. And in 2009, it was demonstrated that during the H1N1 crisis, they were able to scale up pretty quickly. In over 3 months, CDC distributed over about 5.5 million doses to pharmacies, and they were able to redistribute to 10,700 stores around the country. So it was a very successful program that we worked in partnership with the CDC back then. As Mr. Roachford said, pharmacists are accessible, the sites are convenient, and this would really provide a great service to the citizens of New Hampshire. There are some measures that have to be taken. We recognize that. I mentioned that they can administer flu shots to anyone. Other vaccines are specific to those 18 years of age or older. And most often they have to be administered through a collaborative practice act with a physician. We're hopeful that the Department of Health and Human Services would look at giving some relief to that because of the pressures on the physicians' offices during this pandemic. And we think that HHS could establish appropriate protocols that can ease those capacity concerns during this critical period, to ensure patients have increased access to convenient and quality care. So to close, we're not asking for a specific dollar amount. We're asking to partner, and we're asking if maybe the state picks up the cost of the testing and the PPE and other materials, but we want to do what we can to aid in a and aid the state in this effort. So with that, Mr. the Director and members of the Gopher Committee, I will conclude my remarks and again say thank you to all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Berkey. Are there any questions for Mr. Berkey? If you would just hit 5-star for us. We'll see your hand raised on the screen. Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a question, sir? Maybe you were on mute, Senator D'Alessandro.
Am I all set now?
You are, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bruce, you mentioned you have 224 stores. Geographically, they must be located throughout the state, or are the preponderance of the stores in the southern tier?
Well, I don't know exactly, Senator, but I would guess that the majority are probably Concord and south. But I do know they exist, going up the highways. They're in Lincoln, they're in Conway, they're in Lebanon. I believe they're in Littleton. And beyond. So, they're not as prevalent in the North Country, but only the moose are.
Right. But you have broad geographic locations. Testing
Absolutely.
Seems to be the issue that's foremost in most people's mind at this point in time. The more people you test, the better situation you have with regard to who has the virus or who doesn't have the virus, the cost of a test, and is there a uniform test that's accepted around the country by the CDC?
I would leave that to the health experts, Senator. I'm sure that there is, and I don't know what the costs are, but I'm sure that the CDC would have that information, if not our own Department of HHS.
Okay. But indeed, with testing being the most prevalent question that's out there, we don't do enough testing. We don't do enough testing. It is a key ingredient to containment of this virus. Is there a plan in place by your group that you could bring forward that says this would be the cost of administering this test, and obviously it's an integral part of dealing with the process.
Senator, we totally agree with you on the testing, and not just from the pharmacy perspective, but I can tell you from every interest group that I do represent, and in terms of, you know, having confidence for the people of New Hampshire and this country to be able to, you know, begin to go back towards a normal life again. And so from that perspective, it will be my pleasure to go and ask my client, the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, and find out what a plan would look like and what would the cost be associated with that plan.
Great. I think that's a key element as we move forward. Every day that I listen to a national radio or television broadcast, one of the key points is we are not testing. We're not testing enough people, and that's a key ingredient to addressing the pandemic. So,
Senator or other members, if I may ask, what would be the timing for when you would like to see a plan like that, besides yesterday?
Well, I think it would be put it on an urgent basis, because
okay.
We be about distributing funds that are directly related to the virus and how we can address the problems that have been beset upon us as a result of this situation. So I would put it in a high category, Bruce.
It's there now. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Jerry.
And thank you, Senator D'Alessandro. Are there any other questions for Mr. Berkey? Seeing or hearing none, we will say thank you, Bruce, for your
interview. Thank you. Appreciate the time. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Our next presentation is from the dental industry, and I believe we have with us Myra Nikitas, and I'm not sure if there's anybody else on the phone representing dental interests. If you are on the phone, if you could hit 5-star, it would let us know which line you're on. Ms. Nikitas, are you with us? Myra Nikitas, are you with us? Is there anybody on the line from either the Dental Society or American Dental Hygienists Association?
Hi, this is Myra.
Hello, Myra. How are you? This is Jerry
Good,
Little on the
you?
GoPro. I am fine, thank you. Is there anyone else joining you this afternoon to represent dental?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not sure if Mike from the Dental Society is going to be joining. So I don't know.
All right.
But I'm here.
Well,
I'm here to represent the Dental Hygienist Association. I did submit some things to the committee. Hopefully that was able to get reviewed in a timely manner before the meeting today.
Yes, we did receive
Perfect.
your materials shortly before the meeting.
Great.
So, what would you like the Legislative Advisory Board to know, Myra?
So, my concerns representing the Dental Hygienist Association, as listed in the information I provided, you know, a lot of us are very scared to go back to work because of the shortage of PPE available at this time, as well as some, as you know, our profession, it produces a lot of aerosols because of the dental equipment. So something that we want to make sure that's included in every dental office that can be supplied to is a evacuation system or an adapter that can help reduce some of those aerosols when we are working, as well as just some of the other recommendations from the CDC as far as, you know, the necessary screening equipment, you know, a thermometer, these types of things. So we've been kind of going back and forth with the task force committee as well about some other things that we like implemented, but just the PPE and making sure that we feel safe to go back to work when it is time to do so. That is the main thing. A lot of companies can produce the N95 masks. There's some that are really authentic ones, and there's some that are, you know, produced and don't have the quality. So we want to make sure that those types of things are considered when supplying us with the necessary PPE to not only protect ourselves but our patients. There was, you know, another concern was, you know, returning back to work, that, you know, dental hygienists, of course, you know, patients are nervous right now. They don't know if they want to have their prophylactic cleanings, and we want to make sure that we ensure that it is safe for all to do so. And if we're called to work to, you know, make sure that we don't lose any benefit going to work and then saying, oh, our schedule fell apart, that, you know, you need to be sent home now, because a lot of us are taking a risk. We are the front lines of this contracting the COVID-19 virus. Many of us have been around for a long time, AIDS and so on and so forth, has you know, with flus and different things. But this is just a different type of virus because it stays in the air for up to 3 hours and on a surface for days. So we want to make sure that we have those proper disinfectant materials and sterilization procedures and enough time to safely treat patients. So we don't want to, you know, treat a patient and then not have enough time to properly disinfect because, you know, our schedule is not jammed, but patient after patient. So these things have to be considered, you know, as well. So those were a few of our concerns, in, you know, going back to work and just the funds that would be available. A lot of things have been discussed with air purification systems in dental offices. These are costly. So, you know, to help kind of reduce the quality of the air and reduce some of those aerosols, these are types of things that are being considered. But if a practice, you know, has a dentist that is, you know, maybe later on in his career, they're not going to want to purchase some of these things. So just things like that need to be considered for the health and safety for all.
Thank you, Ms. Nikitas. Are there any questions? Is there anybody else representing dental interests on the phone that wishes to speak? If so, if you could hit 5-star on your keypad, we can identify you. Senator Susie, do you have a question?
Yes, actually, I was wondering if perhaps since we're running ahead of schedule, that might be the reason that someone else might not be available from the society. I don't know if we've reached out to them, but it looks like they weren't scheduled until 2:20. So
that's always a possibility. We didn't have an awful lot of advanced information as to who would be representing the Dental Society.
Okay. Thank you.
We're not sure who to expect. You'll see we have a TBD on the speaker information on your agenda. Well, thank you then. If there are no questions for Ms. Nikitas, really appreciate the time that you spent with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your time.
I do believe, from looking at the screen here, that our 240 speaker from the New Hampshire Optometric Association, Dr. Scott Huffer, is with us. Are you there, Doctor?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine. Would you mind going? We realize that we're way ahead of schedule, but if you are able to, we'd like to hear your presentation now.
I am more than ready to go. I appreciate it. I'm ready. First, I'd like to start and say thank you all for your time and the opportunity to speak today, and certainly all of you for your public service. My name is Dr. Scott Huffer. I am the president-elect of the New Hampshire Optometric Association, And I'm also an owner, partner of Focused Eye Care in Nashua, New Hampshire. We're an independent eye care office where we have five different providers and 28 employees. And we've been taking care of patients in the Nashua community for many, many years. We're now on our fourth generation of ownership. Today, I'm here to specifically represent the New Hampshire Optometric Association. We are a group of about 180 doctors of optometry practicing throughout the state in a wide variety of practice settings, from private practices to chain settings to employees at hospitals. In case you're unaware, doctors of optometry are essential frontline doctors who provide eye care to an estimated 1 million New Hampshire citizens. More than two-thirds of the New Hampshire population needs eye care on an annual or more frequent basis. We provide critical care to those with serious health conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, cancer, heart disease, and autoimmune disease. Further, we often find ocular manifestations of these diseases before patients have any symptoms or are aware of their diagnosis. Doctors of optometry provide important support to and co-management with primary care providers. We provide urgent and emergent eye care services, reducing the burden on urgent care centers and hospital emergency departments. Doctors of optometry further provide a majority of eye care for Medicaid and Medicare populations, particularly in the rural areas of the state. Throughout this pandemic, we have seen drastic implications in our businesses. As per CDC guidelines, we have mostly closed for all but urgent or emergent eye care, while some offices, in order to preserve the safety of their employees and the public and their cash reserves, they've closed entirely. About 15% of our membership has chosen to close their offices entirely until they can reopen more safely and be a little more solvent financially. There's been extreme lost revenue. On average, our membership has indicated an 80% loss of revenue on surveys. All are operating at significant negative cash flow, operating using up business reserves frequently that were planned for expansions, renovations, equipment. In order to live with these decreased revenues, we've also had to furlough large amounts of employees. Our average office in our membership employs 10 people, and the average office has furloughed 6 of them. So other struggles we're dealing with, we've begun getting some funds through PPP sources, and getting our employees back has been very difficult. It was something that we didn't perceive would be so difficult in advance, but it is turning into some significant ill will between employees and employers, and also between the employees who've been staying on to see the emergent patients who would really love to see some help come back, and they're having a little animosity towards their coworkers, and we're going to have to deal with smoothing those relationships in the future. Further, access to employees has been complicated because of the lack of childcare opportunities for employees. We've also dealt with many different federal programs, grants, figuring out telehealth, patients wanting to be seen even though guidelines exist that shouldn't have them in the office. So what does this mean down the road? The patient's perceptions are that it is unsafe to leave the house. Even as business is starting to look like it may come back, many patients don't feel comfortable leaving the house or coming into a public setting. In my office, we've had issues getting patients with significantly emergent issues coming in. And certainly we'll have to spend a lot of time educating patients on what we're doing to control infection and how they can help us control infection when they visit. I think in the future we're going to see significant disruption of doctor-patient relationships with potentially online corporations trying to pass off substandard eye exams and such. I think practices will see a significant reduction in their efficiency as we have to distance patients, as we can see a lot less patients in a day. And I'm very concerned that in the long term, that's going to increase costs. And I'm concerned that some offices are really going to start to look at which insurances are reimbursing the lowest and may look at dropping plans. And I'm concerned that that may affect how many offices are providing for Medicaid in the future. I'm also concerned that many of our offices may not recover and may close permanently. We did have a few people in our survey suggest that they may not be able to remain open after this is finished. I'm really concerned that this overall decreases access to care, which decreases access to vision and low rehab care, critical medical eye care for vision-threatening conditions, and overall leads to vision loss in the population with huge secondary health costs. Our profession generally, offices don't have charitable resources. Many hospitals have charities that they can lean on a little bit in these times or have other ways of raising funds. We do not. We have had about 50% of our memberships who was polled suggest they have been able to get PPP funding. It is a little tricky to use the PPP funding when we can't get people to return to work. The funding also is required to be used within 8 weeks, and it's going to be very difficult to use it within that time frame. We have also received, many offices have received Health and Human Services grants. They have been very small. I know in my office, we did receive one of these grants, and the amount of the grant is less than 10% of 1 month's average revenue in our office. So it's a very small amount of money. I will say one resource for us that has been wonderful, the state has been wonderful at providing personal protective equipment to our members. It's appreciative, and it's been very, very, we're appreciative of that. And it's a critical component of us being successful moving forward. We really appreciate those efforts and hope for sure that they can continue. So the key needs of our members really are mostly financial at this point. They've requested specific payroll assistance in order to better compete with unemployment as we get employees back. While PPP is a great program, additional grants, very low interest loans would be very, very helpful. The things that could cover things beyond payroll and could also be forgivable. I think in the long term, some situation of low interest or forgivable loans to facilitate consolidation will be critical. Some of the offices that don't survive facilitating their transition, new jobs in other offices for employees would be great. And anything that could facilitate the acquisition of practices or practices merging, I think, would be fantastic. I think continuing to support avenues for personal protective equipment are very, very critical. Grants that supported telemedicine would also be wonderful. And further, some money should be spent on public awareness. This process has really taught our patient base that routine care can be deferred and that it's not important now. And I think that's a really awful message, and it needs to be combated significantly. So in our business, much of our care patients perceive as routine, and they come in not knowing they have a condition. And frequently conditions are found during the appointments long before any symptoms would be present. And delaying these diagnoses is going to also increase vision loss within the population, increase healthcare costs, and decrease quality of life. So each of those items would ensure long-term survival of our businesses and really small medical care facilities throughout the state. The offices are critical in maintaining access to care, and particularly in rural communities, in the safest manner possible, reducing the burden on emergency care departments and limiting the spread of infection. Delays and disruptions in eye care impact the work performance and the quality of life of New Hampshire citizens. Other considerations, things to think about. I know medical institutions of all shapes and sizes have suffered staggering losses through this time. And at the same time, medical insurers have continued mostly to collect premiums as normal, but they have had significantly less claims to pay. From what I know, insurers are generally required to spend at least 80% of premiums on healthcare claims and activities to improve the quality of care. And in this environment, that's almost impossible without either refunding premiums or contributing to providers without having them rendered services. And somehow, someone should hold the insurance industry accountable for this, for meeting those requirements. So in summary, I would say I'm sure this the Gopher plans to allocate money to small healthcare offices, to maintaining healthcare, and I would really like specifically to make sure that optometry is included in those plans, so that we can continue to provide good, clear vision today and tomorrow for the citizens of New Hampshire. That concludes what I have to formally present. I'm happy to field questions at this time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffer. Are there questions from members of the advisory board? Senator Susie, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. Thank you. You had mentioned earlier the possibility of doing other forms of loans besides those already available, like PPP. Do you have an estimated dollar amount of what the society membership would be looking for?
I could get that back to you. I've been thinking about that specifically. I think as our society, looking through over the course of all of the recommendations, that would ballpark $5 million would maintain solvency within the profession. If you'd like me to look into that further, I'm happy to get back to you with a more formal number.
Thank you. The $5 million is a helpful estimate, but if you have a more precise number, that would be welcomed as well. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Further questions for Dr. Hoffer? Not seeing any or hearing any. Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffer, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much all for having me. And thanks again.
You're welcome. I believe Senator Susie may have been correct in her analysis that possibly we had not heard from folks from the Dental Society because we got a bit ahead of schedule. This afternoon, we are expecting to hear from Ms. Jackson, Ms. Rosato, and Mr. Auerbach. However, we can't tell whether or not any of them have joined us on the phone. If either of those folks are with us, if they could hit 5-star, we can try to identify the phone line that you're calling in on. We'll give you a minute to do that.
Hi, this is Dr. Lori Rosato. I'm on the call.
Thank you, Doc.
Hi, this is Mike Auerbach. I'm on the call.
Excellent. Ms. Jackson? Well,
hi, this is Mike Auerbach.
Hello, Mr. Auerbach. How are you?
Doing okay. How are you, sir?
I am well. This is Jerry Little at the Gopher office. Why don't you go right ahead with your presentation for the Legislative Advisory Board if you're ready.
Certainly. Thank you. And as many of you know, this is the mission of the NHDS, New Hampshire Dental Society, to represent dentistry and to advocate for the public oral health. Dental care, as you know, comes in many different forms. It comes in private practice, community health centers, federally qualified health centers, mobile units, and others among them, DSOs as well. With over 1,000 New Hampshire licensed dentists, nearly 760 of them are New Hampshire Dental Society members, the state has ample capacity for every dental patient, regardless of his or her socioeconomic status. As we all know, the pandemic has heavily impacted every resident and every industry in the state, including dentistry. In mid-March, in response to the pandemic, the New Hampshire Dental Society voluntarily recommended that its members voluntarily postpone all elective appointments and focus solely on emergency and urgent care for patients. This recommendation was part of an effort to flatten the curve and conserve much-needed PPE supplies for frontline workers. However, it also resulted in widespread layoffs, in many cases dental office closures, while at the same time forced residents and their children to wait for nearly 2 months for elective dental treatment, and that wait continues. Without dentists open to see elective patients since mid-March, we are starting to see a dramatic increase in dental emergencies. Dr. Rosado, are you on the call?
I am.
Okay. Perhaps you can lead us a little bit more about the challenge that you're facing as a dentist.
Sure. So essentially, you know, the Dental Society and all the dentists that belong, we're greatly concerned that if the current situation persists, more and more patients are going to lose access to their dentist. It's been almost 6 weeks since most dental offices have been closed, and the crisis in dentistry is building that we're concerned is going to become a public health crisis. We have a lot of infections happening, and smaller infections are turning into larger infections, which are turning into much costlier amounts of treatment and needing specialists that probably wouldn't have been needed. So with the building number of infections and crisis that we're facing, we know that we need to get reopened, and we need to reopen soon. So our focus right now in the past 6 weeks has been to get everybody set up with their appropriate PPE. Not every office is, we've learned that not every office is set up with the appropriate PPE. So some offices are ready to open and some offices are not ready. But we know that more funding is needed, one, to get the appropriate PPE, and two, to get the recommended equipment that many of our personnel are requesting from us. So we've reached a point where we know we can open safely with the appropriate equipment, but it's very hard for most dental offices right now, and even especially public health dental offices, to open because they don't have the funds to purchase the equipment, and some don't even have the funds to purchase the appropriate PPE.
And it's very important that every dental practice reopens as soon as possible to ensure that there aren't as many obstacles for utilization of care. We want to make sure we spread as much or open up as many practices as possible to get so that short wait times will be shortened and that patients could get the care they need. One of the central elements of this, it's going to require a significant financial investment. The cost of PPE is going up even now, and it's expected to continue on even after the pandemic recedes. This is going to be a very difficult challenge for dentists to reopen without a little bit of assistance. And what we're proposing is, if funding were obtained to help dental practices around the state offset the cost of PPE, medical equipment, and the like, more dental practices could reopen quickly. And therefore, we're asking for the creation and establishment of a dental practice pandemic recovery fund with an investment of $20 million. All eligible dental practices, whether they are private or community health centers and the like, would have to outline their PPE needs and their equipment needs while applying for a maximum grant of $25,000. This is a small percentage of what really is needed, but is a much-needed infusion of funds. Dr. Rosado, could you give me a little bit more flesh about this?
In terms of the amount of funds for each office, practice,
right?
Each
practitioner? Yes.
Yeah, in general, I mean, I would say to lowball it, I would say each dentist, and some dental practices have more than one dentist, but each dentist is already going to occur somewhere in the range of $25,000 in needed equipment, whether it's PPP or equipment.
And we understand that this is a significant investment. We also understand that this is a very worthwhile investment. As most of you know, the oral cavity is part of the overall health. And in many cases right now, people are waiting too long as their oral health conditions worsen and thereby their physical conditions worsen. So we're hoping that we can get our dental practices up and running as soon as possible to ensure the health of the people, the residents, as well as these small businesses. And at this point, I'd be glad, and Dr. Rosado and I would be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks very much.
The one last thing I'd just like to add in is, you know, in what we're asking for cost, that's what we're estimating at this point. We don't know if there's going to be further requirements for air filtration systems or anything in that nature, which that will open up into a whole nother level of what's needed. But in the immediate need, this is what we're asking for.
And we, of course, are more than happy to work with the state, with the leadership on this team, as well as the entire state leadership on other initiatives in order to get the people's lives back in order here.
Thank you. Questions from the board for either of our speakers?
Sincerely appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time, everyone. Thank you so much for your help with this.
You're welcome. We are, as you can notice, well ahead of schedule, but I understand our final two speakers are on the line at this moment, so this is sort of a warning heads up for Fire Marshal Paul Parisi and Mr. Stawaz of AMR. We're about ready to hear from the two of you, so if you are prepared. Marshal Parisi, are you with us this afternoon, sir?
I am, sir.
Great. Thank you. And Mr. Stawaz, are you also on the line?
I am as well. Thank you.
Phenomenal. Thank you both very much. Please go ahead with your presentations on public safety and the impact COVID-19 has had on you.
Well, thank you, Director Little. Good afternoon, and good afternoon, members of the General Court. My name is Paul Parisi. It's my privilege to serve as the State Fire Marshal. I'd first like to express my appreciation for the invitation to testify in front of this board of Gopher. I'm honored to have the opportunity to do so. And in an effort to bring forth a complete overview of this topic, I have solicited the input from the following fire service leaders for this presentation: Chief Robert Buxton, the president of the New Hampshire Association of Fire Chiefs; Captain Bill McQuillan, the president of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire; Chief Deb Pendergast, who is the director of the New Hampshire Fire and EMS Academy; and President Glenn Davis of the New Hampshire State Firemen's Association. So over the last 7 weeks that our state has been engaged in the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen a profound impact on the New Hampshire Fire Service, both from its members' health and safety to the ever-changing capabilities of our departments. In the New Hampshire Fire Service are approximately 5,600 firefighters. 70% of these firefighters are volunteer or on-call members, and then the balance of 30% are full-time career firefighters. In addition to their duties of responding to fires and conducting technical rescue, approximately 84% of the 226 municipal fire departments also provide EMS, or emergency medical services, to their communities. While New Hampshire firefighters have been engaged in this battle, we are proud to report that we have been at the tip of the spear, answering every call with compassion and loyalty, and will continue to respond to our citizen requests for help throughout this pandemic and beyond. In addition to answering routine calls for service in order to effectively respond to the community's needs, fire department members have been operating roles outside their normal scope of duties. Firefighters are filling many jobs in this crisis, from being leaders in their respective emergency operations centers within their towns and cities, to participating in regional public health networks and in setting up and assisting in the operation of alternative care sites or surge centers. Firefighters have had to quickly adapt to the current situation by creating and implementing a different call response model than we've always been used to. In the past, members had ordinarily responded to calls by rushing into houses and taking care of citizens when called. And now we have to take time to safely, don personal protective equipment, cautiously approach subjects or patients, and asking questions from a safe distance. Even using this method, which is the safest reasonable response, firefighters have experienced unprotected exposures and as a result have had to been quarantined continually throughout this pandemic. In fact, as of this afternoon, 220 members of the New Hampshire Fire Service have suffered unprotected exposures and have been in quarantine for some period of time, from a couple of days to the full 14-day required time period. The impact of these quarantine situations have varied across the state in both the impact of the department as well as to their mutual aid partners. Some of the more significant exposures in departments have led to some fairly significant quarantine situations, such as 6 members of the Laconia Fire Department being quarantined all at once, 7 members in Holderness, 9 members in the city of Nashua and the town of Londonderry, and then 10 members all at one time in the towns of Fremont and Peterborough. Depending on the municipality, you can imagine that in some of these quarantine situations, it has resulted in large percentages of their department being out of service at one time and not being able to provide full fire emergency medical response protection to their communities. Also of note, members have had to immediately adjust to the daily changing information that comes from the CDC in regards to PPE and exposure guidelines, particularly at the beginning of this incident. New standard operating procedures were disseminated frequently to stay up to the most up-to-date information, and keeping members informed was and continues to be challenging. Additionally, constantly changing unprotected exposure algorithms were used to determine if a member had sustained an unprotected exposure, who their close contacts may have been, and that would protect not only other members of the fire and emergency services, but also protect public contacts, and that has been a continually time-consuming undertaking. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, recruitment and retention in the New Hampshire Fire Service had been identified as a critical statewide issue. In volunteer and call departments, finding and recruiting individuals that have had interest in the field and also want to sacrifice time away from their families to dedicate the training necessary to become a firefighter was tough. In New Hampshire, fire chiefs now fear that this pandemic will have an even more significant impact on the ability to recruit community members who now have to consider that during the course of their service to their fellow citizen, they may expose themselves and or their family to the virus, as well as all the other typical dangers that they face. In career departments, several economic factors that had already made hiring good qualified candidates a problem. For similar reasons as the volunteer and call side, it will be undoubtedly more difficult to encourage the next generation of this integral emergency workforce to be on the front lines of what we know to be an already dangerous profession. Finally, and certainly as critical to consider, are the lasting effects that this prolonged event will have on the mental health of our responders. Repeated exposure to a potentially life-threatening virus can have a cumulative effect on the psyche of any individual. We must remember what impact it could have on our firefighters as we deal with the situation and the potential dangers on each and every incident. Although not fully understood at this time, the financial impact of this crisis will undoubtedly be felt for years to come. Communities are currently spending money on callback and overtime for personnel, emergency operations center tasks, and PPE in response to this ongoing event, all of which were unanticipated in their current budgets. These necessary financial expenditures will most certainly result in operational budget deficiencies in at least the preceding months, and as we hopefully continue to enter the recovery phase of this pandemic. Even if the public assistance portion of the FEMA-approved costs are reimbursed at the 75% rate, 25% of the costs would still need to be absorbed by the cities and towns, and this assistance won't be awarded for some time. Also, the costs that do not qualify for federal assistance and aren't able to be recovered could be substantial. The long-term impact of this incident is likely to have devastating effects, from deferring capital expenditures such as equipment and apparatus to layoff of frontline personnel. The clear and palpable impact on the ability for fire chiefs to provide essential services to the communities seems inevitable. We understand that one of the hardest parts of this conundrum is how to bridge that financial gap during what is undoubtedly presenting to be a significant economic downturn in our state, while also balancing the critical emergency service delivery to our citizens. Are there ways to take advantage of any funding to potentially minimize the impact our state will feel in this area? While we know there is no magic bullet, the leaders of New Hampshire Fire Service would respectfully offer the following suggestions. We would encourage that the committee consider a funding methodology or grant opportunity to be able to help municipalities to continue the mission of providing essential services to the communities. We need to keep our first responders on the front lines during this state of emergency and beyond. Perhaps the committee could consider creating a simple, competitive process to apply for funding for apparatus, equipment, and/or staffing needs. Also, is it possible that a reserve fund could be established to distribute resources if we find ourselves in another surge, whereas the state could act quickly with local partners to react and direct resources immediately? We are also strongly encouraging that we collectively look at the human toll that this event is taking on our members and perhaps build out a robust mental health component to address it as the stresses continue to mount. We have seen the mental anguish of isolation of responders in quarantine and the knowledge that they are potentially causing the spread of infection to their family. Incentivizing the use of equipment that allows our responders to maintain their own safety and minimize a potential exposure is also something that we would encourage, such as the use of mechanical compression devices during medical emergencies. Lastly, perhaps funding an increase to remote learning opportunities to ensure the most current updates are communicated to providers in the field so that the best practices are employed and the safety of the public is ensured. In closing, the women and men of New Hampshire Fire Service continue to stand ready to respond to help our fellow citizens and neighbors in their time of need. I thank you for the opportunity to present to you today and would be happy to answer any questions the members may have.
Thank you, Marshall. Any questions from the members of the Advisory Board for Fire Marshal Caristi? Representative Walner, do you have a question? You may need to unmute your phone, Representative Walner.
Sorry about that. I thank you for the presentation. It was very interesting, and I thought the idea of setting up a fund, and I assume that communities would be able to apply to that fund for what their individual needs are. How would you see that being administered, a fund like?
Thank you for the question, Representative. I don't know that we necessarily have the answer to that, but it certainly could involve members of both the our office here at the Fire Marshal's office. It could involve members of the Fire Academy and perhaps members of the Chiefs Association. Essentially a committee that could review grant applications. But we would want to make sure that it's a fairly streamlined process, that it's accessible to not only career chiefs, but to volunteer departments as well. Departments that have internet access don't have internet access. We'd want to make sure that it's a streamlined process and not a complicated method to apply.
Yes, thank you. And I think that these funds sound like they need to get out to our communities fairly rapidly. I had one other question, just a little a technical kind of thing. But when firefighters are quarantined, are they quarantined in their own homes or are they being quarantined in hotels? And if so, who picks up the cost of that?
Thank you for the question, Representative. So currently, we do have hotel rooms across the state that are currently being picked up, the cost of which are being picked up by the state which we're being told will be reimbursed by FEMA at the end of the pandemic or the end of the state of emergency. So they have the ability to quarantine in a hotel room. They can certainly quarantine at home if they have that ability. Some folks have the ability to separate themselves in their house, and so therefore they can stay at home. But some have, of course, small children and so forth, and don't have the ability to go home.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Additional questions for State Fire Marshal Parisi? Not seeing any. So thank you, Marshal Parisi. And Mr. Sewaz of AMR, are you still on the phone with us, sir?
I am, yes.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. What would you like the committee to hear?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity, Director Little, to speak to the honorable members of the committee, and thank you all of the committee members for allowing me to present a little bit of information about the emergency medical services side of the equation for public safety in New Hampshire. My name is Christopher Sewaz. I'm the regional director for AMR of New Hampshire and Maine. Many of you may be familiar with my weekly opioid report, which still comes out, but now we are obviously focused on the coronavirus. Emergency medical services in New Hampshire are currently provided by a variety of staffing models determined primarily by local New Hampshire communities. According to the latest published information available, approximately 47% of the 911 ambulances in New Hampshire are operated by some type of fire service model, whether it be professional and or volunteer. 43% are operated by commercial non-hospital services, such as AMR, 5% by hospitals, and the remaining 5% by local government non-fire department services. AMR is New Hampshire's largest employer of EMS personnel, employing over 200 licensed New Hampshire EMS providers that perform approximately 17% of all of the 911 ambulance responses in New Hampshire. AMR is the largest provider of emergency ambulance services in New Hampshire, responding to approximately 34,000 911 calls annually. In addition to providing 911 services, AMR is the primary medical transportation provider for approximately half of all of the licensed hospital beds in New Hampshire, moving more than 15,000 patients between medical facilities on an annual basis. All of our operational revenue at AMR is generated by patient transports. No subsidies or direct tax dollars are received from the New Hampshire communities or facilities that AMR serves. And AMR, in fact, actually currently reimburses over $750,000 back to the New Hampshire communities we serve to offset dispatching costs for our EMS services. Commercial providers in New Hampshire that deliver services to municipalities and medical facilities are historically not eligible for any federal or state funding opportunities for cost reimbursement during disasters, nor are they typically eligible for grant opportunities during normal operational times because of their status as a commercial provider. The impact of COVID-19 thus far on EMS operations in New Hampshire, approximately a 27% reduction in 911 responses, with a corresponding reduction in billed revenue opportunities. This reduction is likely similar statewide. These numbers are derived from Nashua and Manchester, and in fact, they may be even more significant in rural areas. There is significantly less human activity, traffic, and personal interactions. However, it does not explain the significant drop in overdoses and generally seen medical conditions like heart attacks and strokes that we are seeing far less of on a regular basis. Approximately 35% reduction in the interfacility or between medical facility transport volumes, with a corresponding reduction in billed revenue opportunities. There is much less movement of patients to tertiary care facilities like Boston or Dartmouth, and much less scheduled movement of patients for regular or non-urgent treatments that need to be done for people who are not ambulatory. We have little to no ability to reduce operational readiness costs, including salaries and benefits. We maintain an ambulance deployment level that is essential and usually cannot reduce in any significant way that level without impacting coverage for the communities that we serve. We've experienced a significant increase in PPE supply and decontamination costs with little to no funding opportunity and a volatile supply chain for resupply. It's required constant monitoring needed to determine burn rates of use of PPE, maintain the security of the supply of PPE, and to educate staff on the rapidly changing CDC recommendations for proper use of PPE. We've also experienced difficulty in obtaining rapid COVID-19 testing opportunities for our staff who may have become potentially exposed. Although I will say that that has, those opportunities have greatly increased within the last several weeks. We've had increased staffing requirements for EOC operations staffing and alternative care site preparation planning and setup. Planning for mass transportation efforts to decompress hospitals, planning for homeless population care and transportation of COVID-positive patients, and planning for nursing home and nursing facility evacuation, placement, and increased need. We've also participated in numerous public COVID testing sites with public health departments of Nashua and Manchester. And we've experienced an increased cost to manage our employees, including wellness checks, coordinating quarantine and isolation when required, and to manage the household personal needs of staff who may be in quarantine, including childcare, family care, and other personal related needs. We've also offered a childcare stipend so that our staff can continue to come to work and not have to worry about lack of childcare while they're doing that. One of the most important things, which I believe Marshall Parisi also mentioned, is the mental health and ongoing wellness of our staff, not only now in the midst of this pandemic, but after the fact when the pandemic has passed. It's something that we think that will be an incredible challenge for many of the public safety agencies that are out there, and we are actively searching for ways to make that our number one priority for retaining staff and recruiting them in the future. We believe that there will be a need for a tremendous amount of increased training for staff going forward, whether it be PPE or social distancing or learning ever-changing ways to address the needs of COVID-positive patients and the medical treatments that are provided to them. On March 20th, New Hampshire Emergency 911 began caller screening for flu-like symptoms of all callers that called 911 in New Hampshire. Although it does not convey specific illness to the first responders, it may assist them in deploying certain universal precautions when responding to those calls. Since that implementation, AMR alone has responded to over 250 of those calls just in Nashua and Manchester. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that I've spent my entire career, 35-plus years as a paramedic in New Hampshire, and I have never experienced anything as unique as this pandemic. I can say, though, as I sit currently right now in the EOC in the city of Manchester, and it's pretty much where I've been for the last month or 6 weeks, I can say that the level of cooperation and ability of the state of New Hampshire to respond to this pandemic has been nothing short of amazing, in my opinion. Relationships that have been formed, the information that has flowed, and the ability to take care of one another to make sure that the job for our community gets done has been absolutely phenomenal. And my hats are off to everybody that has been involved in that process. I thank you for your time and for the opportunity to present to you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sewaz. Are there any questions from members of the advisory board? I'll give you a minute or two to five-star in and let us know if you have a question for Mr. Sewaz. Seeing none, thank you very much, sir, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it.
So that brings us to the end of the planned presentations for April 29th. I will just give you a quick review of the agenda for the meeting on Friday, this Friday, May 1st at 1 o'clock. At this point, we have we're going to open with a presentation from the Gopher staff person, Lisa English. Is on our staff over here. A number of people have asked us to look into other sources of federal funding that is coming into the state beyond the CARES Act funds that we have received so far. So Lisa has been analyzing that situation. We'll give a quick update, about 20 minutes or so, on other sources of federal funding available. We are then going to get back into discussing public safety. We'll have a joint presentation by the Police Association of New Hampshire and the Professional Firefighters Association. And then that will be followed by moving into discussion of developmental disability community issues. Director of Public Affairs for Community Bridges, Sarah Aiken, will join us. After that, we'll touch on agricultural issues with Agriculture Commissioner Sean Jasper and Rob Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau. At 2:30, we're planning to move into early child care and child care generally. We're going to hear from a couple of folks from Department of Health and Human Services on early child care issues, and then we're going to close the day on Friday with a presentation by Early Learning New Hampshire. So that is the schedule coming up for Friday. That agenda will be posted shortly. Are there any questions from members of the advisory board for me or any other issues you'd like to discuss this afternoon? Well, hearing none, Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a question, sir?
Yeah, Jerry, thank you. Jerry, you will go to try to get us a list of further gives based on the Emergency Healthcare System Relief Fund. The last report we got was April 17th, 2020, of the allocations. You were going to bring us up to date on how much money has been given out. Right at that point in time, we had $125,600,000. That was accounted for that we thought would be reimbursable as it was COVID spending. Have we got an update on any other monies that have gone out the door?
We placed the request for the update, but I have not received it yet. And as soon as we do, we'll certainly share it with you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hennessy?
Thank you, Director Little. Just a follow-up for one of the questions I had asked for was the information on what the school districts have had to spend. Have you received that information yet?
No, we have not. So your question is, what have school districts spent on COVID-19, or is it just generally
on all of the expenses related to COVID-19,
everything.
Yeah.
Distance and, learning equipment, et cetera.
Right. Commissioner Edelblue said that he had started to track that and would get us that information.
We will get in touch with Commissioner Edelblue and see if he can give us some information by the meeting on Friday.
Thank you.
Other requests for information? Hearing none and seeing nothing on the screen, I'll give you one more second to make your request. Then, hearing none, we're going to let you go about 15 minutes early today. It is at this point 2:45, and this meeting of the Gopher Legislative Advisory Board is ended. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.